Okay. So really the most fitting tribute, I very much appreciate it. None of this could have happened without you. None of this could have happened without you coming in week in and week out to come and to learn, and the excitement that this class has generated and the learning that this course has generated really speaks for itself, and the crowds that have come. It's very moving and very fitting, and I appreciate that. Looking forward to next season, but we have a lot to do tonight still as we conclude our course. And first, let me just announce one more last, we'll announce again at the end. This coming Shabbos, we'll have our official Siyum. This entire course has been sponsored by the Weinberg family in memory of Dr. Mark Weinberg. And we'll have a special Siyum with a special guest speaker. Rabbi Gedalia Berger will be here an hour before Mincha, 5:45. Siyum, special Yahrzeit lecture in memory of Mark, whose Yahrzeit is in the month of Nisan, followed by a Shalosh Shuda sponsored by the Weinberg family, and Zev, who will be in town, will share a few words about his father. So please join us for that special conclusion of this entire course, as we thank the Weinbergs for really making this whole thing possible. Tonight's final lecture is on the Rav, Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik HaLevi, the great Rosh Yeshiva from Yeshiva University. I begin with the words of Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb. Rabbi Lamb was the president or chancellor of Yeshiva University for over 35 years, from the mid-70s till his retirement in, I think it was 2013. And in his eulogy of the Rav, which he gave not at the time of his death, but several years later at one of the memorials that they had, he opened by saying that the Rav was so enormous, was so multifaceted, that there really isn't anybody who could have given appropriate eulogy for him other than Rav Soloveitchik himself. There is nobody who can encompass all that he was. Now, Rabbi Lamb is no intellectual slouch himself. He is well-published, quite a brilliant speaker and orator and writer. And for him to say that there's really nobody around who can summarize the life of the Rav, so I follow in his footsteps and really have very little to be able to offer to try to do so. I feel doubly less than qualified to do so, because out of all the figures that we've learned, the Rav was actually, he died in 1993, which means that there are many, many, many students of his who are still alive today. My students, when I was in high school, I went to MTA, Yeshiva University's high school. My students were almost all students of his, direct students of his. And many of my colleagues are students of his students or direct students of his. And because of that, as opposed to all the historical figures that we've studied, so we could share whatever we can about them, but they're all a historical figure. When we speak about the Rav, which we'll do tonight, I know that there are so many people today who, if they were to hear the words that I would share, and I stand in pretty good confidence that they won't hear the words that I'm going to be sharing today, but if they would, they would all say, you know, das ist nicht der Rav. You didn't do a good job. You didn't really describe. You covered this, but there was so much more about that aspect or this facet of him. And how could you do that all in an hour? It doesn't work. The books that have been written just since his passing, the 25th anniversary was just last year of his passing, read by Herschel Schechter, current Rosh Yeshiva and Yeshiva University, one of his primary students, has written at least, that I know, three Hebrew volumes detailing his life and his experiences. And Rabbi Berkefer wrote a two-volume English book. Rabbi J.J. Schechter, also a student of his, has an 8-series online lecture that you can listen to detailing his life, and dozens and dozens and dozens of articles and essays and talks that have been given. It's enormous. And so I know that we're not going to do it justice. And so with that disclaimer, we're going to begin. I have tried as much as possible to use the words of his students. I've given you in your handout in front of you as many quotes as I can so that we can allow his actual students to speak for themselves, and as well as we always do in this course, to try to actually study some of his works. There are going to be 3 of his works. He published over 25 books, besides for dozens of essays. And so we'll still focus on 3 in your addendum to try to give a taste, and it's just going to be a taste of what he was and who he was through the words of his students and through his own words. With that, let's begin with the introduction. Dr. David Schatz, who is a professor today in Yeshiva University in Stern, and I actually was a classmate of his son when I was in high school, he writes the following in his introduction to The Lonely Man of Faith, which we'll get to a little bit later this evening. Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik was not only one of the outstanding Talmudists of the 20th century, but also one of its most creative and seminal Jewish thinkers. His stature was such that he was widely known simply as the Rav, the Rabbi Par Excellent. Drawing from a vast reservoir of Jewish and general knowledge, Rabbi Soloveitchik brought Jewish thought and law to bear on the interpretation and assessment of the modern experience. On the one hand, he built bridges between Judaism and the modern world, yet at the same time, he vigorously upheld the integrity and autonomy of the Jews' faith commitment. And the reason why I wanted to bring this quote to begin with is because it touches on a lot of the points that we're going to speak about. Number one, he was an outstanding Talmudist. First and foremost, the Rav was a Talmud Chacham par excellence, and we're going to talk about his abilities in learning the type of shiurim that he gave. But he was also creative, a creative thinker, a seminal creative thinker of the Jewish world in the 20th century, a philosopher who has shaped the way the American Jewish community thinks. Literally, the way we think is using his eyeglasses and the way that he gave us a vision of certain things, and we'll cover many of those as we go through tonight as well. He mentions drawing from the reservoir both of Jewish and general knowledge. We'll see how highly educated he was in the secular world as well. And his goal of the modern experience. Taking the Jew, he was the Rav from 1903 to 1993, lived in the 20th century, and he was going to bring the halachic Jew into this modern world of America that we found ourselves in post-World War II, which was the shtetl and the world of Europe, and now we're here in the Golden of Medina, the modern world of America, and how does a modern but halachic Torah Jew bridge these gaps of what were two different worlds? And that was going to be one of the primary things that he was going to help us with, vigorously upholding the integrity and autonomy of his faith, yet dealing with and bridging the modern world. Let's start with a little biographical sketch. So the first thing we need to know about the Rav is that he came from a royal Torah heritage, literally royalty. Born in 1903 in what was then Russia and became Poland and Belarus. But he was from a rabbinic dynasty that was a 200-year-old rabbinic dynasty. We're going to run through this quickly, these names. We've covered actually some of these names in our classes. His grandfather, his father's father was the great Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik. His great-grandfather and his namesake was of Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, who wrote the Sefer known as the Beis HaLevi. His great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather, excuse me, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the Nitziv, who was the Rosh Hashiva in Volozhin. And then his great-great-great-great-grandfather was Rav Chaim Volozhin, who we studied together, was the student of the Vilna Gaon and the founder of the Volozhiner Yeshiva. So he literally was a direct line from what we would consider the nobility, the royalty, the dynasty of the Soloveitchik namesake in Torah. And from his mother's side, he as well was the grandson of Rabbi Eliyahu Feinstein, who was a descendant of a long line of Rebbes, tracing themselves back to the Tosfos Yontif, the Shlod, the Marshal, and all the way back to Rashi. So he is coming from quite a line. Now, there are those who we can give an entire class just on his lineage. We're going to mention it just to understand where he was coming from. His father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, was actually the head of the rabbinical school at Yeshiva University Ritz, or Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. And he succeeded his father, which we'll speak about in a few moments. So he is from a long line of rabbis. He was given a traditional Talmud Torah education, recognized as a genius very, very early on. There are different reports. I mentioned this. It's clear that at some point he had a melamed. His main rebbe was his father until his early 20s. And he considered his father to be his rebbe, quoted him all the time as his rebbe. At some point in his younger years, he had a melamed who was a Chabad melamed. And there are different reports. I don't know what really happened. It's hard for me to be able to decipher from the different ways it's quoted, whether or not it was unbeknownst or by his mother or his father. At some point, this Chabad Malami taught him the Tanya, which we had a whole class on, the first Lubav Chabad Rebbe, the Bala Tanya, and mystical teachings. And then his parents, his father, who comes from this long line of Litvaks, very anti-Hasidish, pulled him out and said, you're going to learn with me from here on out. But there are different reports as to the type of influence that had on him from being exposed to Hasidus at a very young age. He was clearly quite a precocious and a brilliant child, and which he followed his entire life. And by the age of 10, we already have reports of Chidushim that he was writing, his own novel Torah thoughts that he would show to his father, that his father took to his father, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, who shared with his Beis Medrash. He was already well known and recognized as a scion of the Soloveitchik Talmudic dynasty. But what I want to share, besides for all the learning that he picked up and the brilliance in Torah from his father and his grandfather, he credits his mother for giving him his religious soul. And I want to share with you a piece that he wrote because it's such a moving piece. It's the first piece in your addendum on page 4. Nope, I'm sorry. It's on page 5. A tribute to the Rebbetzin of Tolna, which was his mother. She published in 1978. And the context is describing the different elements that a child picks up from his mother and from his father, the different types of learning that one gets. And he says, I admit, is on the bottom of page 5 again, that I am not able, this is his words, to define precisely the Mesorah, the traditional role, it should be of the Jewish mother. I can't define it precisely, but what I'm going to do is by circumscription, I hope to be able to explain it. So he writes, permit me to draw on my own experiences. I used to have long conversations with my mother. In fact, it was a monologue rather than a dialogue. She talked, and I happened to overhear. What did she talk about? I must use a halachic term in order to answer this question. She talked mi'inyana diyom, of whatever was going on of the day, a yontif, a Shabbos, whatever was coming up. I used to watch her arranging the house in honor of a holiday. I used to see her recite prayers. I used to watch her recite the Sidra every Friday night, going over the Parsha. And I still remember the nostalgic tune that she would use. I learned from her very much. Most of all, I learned that Judaism expresses itself not only in formal compliance of the law, but also in a living experience. She taught me that there is a flavor, a scent, a warmth to mitzvot. I learned from her the most important thing in life, to feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of His hand resting upon my frail shoulders. Without her teachings, which quite often were transmitted to me in silence, I would have grown up as a soulless being, dry and insensitive. The laws of Shabbat, for instance, were passed on to me by my father. They were part of Musar Avicha, the teachings of one's father. But the Shabbos as a living entity, as a queen, that was revealed to me by my mother. It's part of what we call Torat Imecha. The father knew much about Shabbos. The mothers lived Shabbos, experienced her presence, and perceived her beauty and splendor. The fathers taught generations how to observe the Shabbos. Mothers taught generations how to greet Shabbos and how to enjoy her 24-hour presence. Beautiful tribute to his mother, a scion of a dynasty of Talmudic genius. And he writes, but it was my mother that taught me how to live it, how to experience the beauty of Shabbos, to greet the queen and enjoy her presence. My father taught me what to do and what not to do, how I can make tea on Shabbos and how I can't make tea on Shabbos. My father taught me that. But my mother taught me what it meant to have a queen in the house and how to enjoy her presence. Beautiful piece in tribute to his mother. Now, besides for his Torah education, which he received, he was also extensively secularly educated. He attended a Free Polish University in Warsaw in 1924 for a number of semesters, and then transferred to the University of Berlin in 1926, where he earned a PhD in philosophy, studied economics, political science, as well as some Hebrew subjects, and was well versed in all of these subjects, all the while continuing his learning in Torah. During this time in Berlin, a fascinating time in Berlin, he was acquainted with both Rabbi Nachum Mendel Schneerson, who became the Lubavitch Rebbe, as well as Rabbi Yitzchak Kuttner, who was the Rosh Hashiva of Yeshiva Chaim Berlin in New York. And these three giants of American Judaism, of America in the 20th century, were together in Berlin in the early 1920s and were all acquainted with each other and maintained their friendship and their communication. We have records of that throughout their lives in the U.S., despite the fact that all three of those yeshivas went in vastly different directions, Chabad, Chaim Berlin, and Yeshiva University. The three heads who studied together in their youth always maintained a connection. There's many stories about that, which is beyond the scope of our brief time tonight, but a fascinating historical footnote. In 1932, recently married, the Rav leaves with a young child to the U.S. Now, to get into the U.S. at the time was not simple. There were very tight immigration laws during that time. We were just coming out of the Depression. And the only way that he was able to get into the country was he was sponsored by what it was today known as Agudas Yisrael, the Agudas Union of, I forget exactly what it was called, that the Agudas HaRabbanim, which sponsored him to come over. And the way that they sponsored him was by giving him a job in Chicago, in the Chicago, I forget what it's called. Did I put it there? No, the theological seminary, the yeshiva in Chicago, was going to give him a position, and he made it to New York. He was on a ship, which happened to have docked here in Halifax for a little bit of time before continuing on to New York. And there was a major party there to greet him, the scion of the dynasty, the child of the Rosh Yeshiva, current Rosh Yeshiva at the time of Yeshiva University, his father, Moshe. And he was detained in Ellis Island for many, many hours. All the reports that describe his arrival describe that he was detained there. And it seems the reason why he was detained is because by the time he got there, Chicago had pulled the offer off the table. They said, we don't have any money. They were in the Depression, coming out of the Depression, 1932. They said, we can't pay him a salary. So they put the ball back in a goodness court and they said, you sponsor him. You originally had sponsored him to give him a job in Chicago. We don't have a job. So they couldn't find him a job. In New York, Yeshiva University, where his own father was, Yeshiva, had no money. They couldn't offer him anything. And there was a whole to-do as to how he was going to get into the country. And we have letters published almost sort of like advertising this tremendous Talmud Chacham who had arrived on the shores of New York, this young, upper 20s, until they finally found him a position in Boston. And he moved to Boston to become the chief rabbi of Boston. It was a conglomerate of 11 different shuls in the Boston area, and he became involved in all of that area. It seems in the beginning that wasn't so thrilling, because in 1935 he applies to become the chief rabbi in Tel Aviv. So this is shortly after arriving in the shores of New York, and he's one of the final three finalists for the position in Tel Aviv, and he travels for his prava to Tel Aviv. It's the only trip in his entire life that he will make to Israel, which we'll speak about in a little bit. This is his only time there. Spends a number of weeks interviewing, actually has an interview with Rav Kook, who passes away later that year. So Rav Kook is at the end of his life, he's already ill. Rav Kook said about the Rav, about Rav Soloveitchik, after his meeting, he said with him, this reminds me for the first time of my own youth in the yeshiva of Volozhin. Rav Kook had studied with the Rav's grandfather, Rav Chaim of Volozhin. This reminds me of my time in yeshiva with Rav Chaim. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, Rav Chaim Volozhin was way before that. With Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. And I see that the brilliance of the grandfather is now held by the grandson. And in a great historical, divine orchestration of events, the Rav loses the election and is not chosen to be the Rav in Tel Aviv, and instead returns to Boston, where he will live for the rest of his life as the Rav in Boston, and eventually is in YU as well. Rabbi Avigdor Amiel got the job in Tel Aviv. In 1959, parenthetically, I put in the notes, he was solicited by the rabbinate in Israel to become the chief rabbi after Rabbi Yitzchak Herzog's death, to take over the position of the chief rabbi of Israel. He declined. He was already where he was, and he was not interested in going for whatever reasons, which are not relevant to us tonight. Now, in Boston, he opens in 1937, 2 years later, the very first Jewish day school in New England, which he calls the Maimonides School, an elementary school. And in this opening, besides for the momentous occasion that he now opened up this this school, he begins, I don't know if this is the first, but one of the early significant positions that he took, which was a, so to speak, daring position in the time, which was co-education, boys and girls learning together. Remember, we're in 1937. We are still in the old shtetl world of Europe, and in the shores of America, the Rav held that's not going to work. And he instituted in an Orthodox school in Maimonides in Boston that the boys and girls would learn together, and they would learn Talmud together, and that's the way to be. I want to share his words. This is a letter that he wrote many years later, 1953, which expresses it. A letter to Rabbi Leonard Rosenfeld. He writes on the top of page 2, as to your question with regards to a curriculum in a coeducational school, I expressed my opinion to you long ago that it would be very regrettable oversight on our part if we were to arrange separate Hebrew courses for girls. Not only is the teaching of Torah Shebaal Peh permissible to girls, and I remember there's a major discussion of whether or not one is allowed to teach the oral law to girls. It stems from a Rambam based on a Gemara who wrote that one should not teach the oral law to girls. And that was, the Rambam lived in the 1100s, 1200s. That was the standard. That was the way that it was for many, many hundreds of years. And certainly in the more, what we would call today, Haredi, right-wing worlds, it was for sure. Sarah Schneerson is just beginning to teach a Beis Yaakov of any age, but that was strictly to girls. And the Rav is now putting them together, and he says it's permissible. Not only is it permissible, but nowadays, an absolute imperative. This policy of discrimination between the sexes as the subject matter and method, which is still advocated by a certain group within our Orthodox community, has contributed greatly to the deterioration and the downfall of traditional Judaism. Boys and girls alike should be introduced into the inner halls of Torah Shebaal Peh. Torah Shebaal Peh is our lifeline. That's our lifeblood. That's what we have as Jews. You can't keep that away. You have to teach them. You have to teach them together. And he was the pioneer in today what's a standard modern Orthodox education, that they'll be taught together. In 1937, he already introduced this into Maimonides. And when it was introduced at the college level in Stern College, Yeshiva University's College for Women, Stern College, and of course it was a whole to-do that we're going to teach Talmud to girls in the Stern College, he said, I'm giving the first year. And he came and he delivered the first lecture in Talmud to girls at Stern College because of his position that he felt how significant that was. So that's, he's in Boston again, 1932, 33. He begins in Boston. 37, he opens up the first elementary school. His father dies in 1941, several years later. And he then succeeded him as the head of the yeshiva. His father was the head of Yeshiva University at the time. He succeeded him, and he remained there until 1986, some 45 years that he taught in Yeshiva University, at which point he was recognized as its foremost Rosh Yeshiva, even though that was never an official title. You know, the official title of Rosh Yeshiva, but everybody recognized him as such, but he never moved to New York. For 45 years, he lived in Boston. He had a shul in Boston, his yeshiva, the Maimonides School, and he commuted to New York back and forth weekly at different times of his life. He had different schedules, how often he went back and forth. And there are many, many stories from him on the trains and getting rides. And he was a commuter for all of those years. He had an apartment on Yeshiva University's campus, which he lived during the week when he was there. And that's how he did it. Over those 45 years, he ordained over 2,000 rabbis, which has placed his undeniable stamp on the modern Orthodox Jewish world of North America, because from those 2,000 rabbis over those 45 years, that is the North American rabbinate of the modern Orthodox world. And what's fascinating, and again, if we had more time, we could go through this in more detail, is the wide range, the diversity of the student, the rabbi, who calls the Rav his Rebbe. From more right-wing, what we would call yeshivish YU, to more left-wing Orthodox, and everything in between, the spectrum of rabbis who would say, the Rav, he's my Rebbe. I learnt with him. I learnt by him. Is a tribute to the genius of the Rebbe, who gave forth so many different colors within the Jewish people. Okay, that's a brief biography. Let's get into some of what he stood for. Now, the first place, you cannot start without his learning and Torah scholarship. First and foremost, he was a giant, just a giant. He was a powerhouse in shir, he was forceful, and he was frightening. And I use that word very specifically because all of the reports about what it was like to be in his shir, particularly in the 50s and the 60s, and those who got him towards the end, he already had mellowed. But in the early years, was a frightening experience because he demanded and expected that when you were in shir, you were prepared. And the questions as you would ask would be on task. And if you didn't measure up, he would let you know. Rabbi Beryl Wine, who was not a student of his but had a lot of interactions, tells that when he was a teenager, he lived in Chicago, Rabbi Wine. So he went, he was recruited, as is the case, by a bunch of yeshivas in other areas to come join. He was in a yeshiva in Chicago, and the other yeshivas would go and say, come to our yeshiva. So he went on a trip one summer to three yeshivas, to Lakewood in New Jersey, to Tells in Cleveland, and to Yeshiva University in New York. He ended up staying in Chicago, but he tells about his experience checking out the yeshivas as a teenager. So after going to Lakewood, he went to YU to sit in the Rav Shir. He's a teenager, 18, 19. So he shows up in Shir. So he didn't know that you're not allowed to do that. So one of the boys stopped him and said, who are you? What are you doing here? So he said, Beryl Wine from Chicago, which they were not impressed. They said, you can't just come into Shir. It doesn't work that way. So he said, listen, I came to check it out from Chicago. So the guy said, I'll tell you what, it's the summertime now, and the Rav gives his Shir with the door open in the summer. Stand, hang out when he comes, after he comes in, you'll come stand right outside the room. You'll be able to hear, but don't come inside. I said, okay. So he starts a 2.5-hour Shir. Rabbi Wine says, unbelievable. He says, like nothing he had ever heard. He says, I remember today, and he says over the Torah that he remembers the Rav of the Masechta in Gittin. He was giving Shir on a machlokas between the Ravid and the Rashba. He says, it's an unbelievable thing. 2.5 hours. He says, but in the middle of the Shir, he called on some poor chap to read one of the sources. And the guy had not prepared it appropriately, and he read it wrong. And Rabbi Wine says, and he laced into him, he tore him to shreds that he totally misread the whole Shir. And Rabbi Wine says, I was outside and he couldn't even see me and I was shaking in my pants, like the fear that he had. And Rabbi Wine said, I decided right then and there, he said, I'm an only son in my family. I've been pampered my whole life. I'm not coming into this classroom, whatever. He went back to Chicago and he stayed there. But that is report after report, the description of what it was like, a terror of la'amito shel Torah, to understand and to get it right. And the pressure, today's day and age, it made the news. A college basketball coach yelled at one of his players and made the news. How could he do that? It's not nice in public and all this thing. Different. That was what he learned from his father, and that is how he gave Shir. As a teacher, he kept his students in awe of his wisdom and in fear of his rebuke. Rav Schechter, current Rosh Hashiva in NYU, I mentioned, wrote all the books, was a primary student. It's very hard to listen. Rav Schechter has many, many lectures about his Rebbe, the Rav, and it's very hard to listen to his point, because he literally cries through the whole thing. You listen to him, he has many on NYU Torah. If you go, check out Rav Schechter on the Rav, he has many, many lectures, and he literally just cries through the whole thing. It's so poignant. And he always says, I see him in front of me always, so it's not like recollections, because all the titles are, recollections or tributes, and he says, he's in front of me. So in one of his lectures, he says that he once asked a question in Shir, and the Rav didn't appreciate the question. That he said, you're asking me a question. It was on a Tosfos, one of the commentaries, and you're asking because you don't understand the Tosfos, that's why you're asking me the question. So Rav Schechter reports in his tribute, he said this laughing now, he said, he gave me a curse, so to speak. He said, you should live long enough that you finally understand the Tosfos. That's how, he's like, you should hopefully one day you'll get it. And he always believed that the way that Orthodoxy was going to capture the American Jewish community was through his intellect, through intellectual and ethical propriety, and that's going to carry the modern world. As Rav Schechter describes, it was all came from a passion for truth. He had a passion for truth and understanding. What would often happen, Rav Schechter says, he's coming to Shir, you gave Shir a week, and then he'd come in the following week, and he would start Shir, and he'd say, everything I said last week is wrong. He said, I thought about it all through Shabbos, and the pshat that I gave, the understanding, I don't like it. So it doesn't sit well with me. And he would take the whole thing apart, and he'd start again. And he would say this always, he says, he got that from his grandfather. His grandfather, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, when he was given a prob in Volozhin to become a Rebbe, there was a big to-do, it's a whole historical thing whether or not he was going to be a Rebbe, because he was a son-in-law of the Netziv, the Rosh Yeshiva, so people said, he doesn't really deserve it, there's all to do. So they gave him a prob. They invited all the great Rabbanim to come listen to Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav's grandfather, give a shir in Volozhin to see whether or not he was qualified to get to the position. And he was given a shir, and it was a brilliant shir, and halfway through the shir, he stops. He was giving a shir in the Rambam, and he said, oh, wait. said, I just remembered there's a comment that the Rambam makes in his commentary to the Mishnah, which is not nearly studied as often as the Rambam's major works. And he pulled that from the shelf, the comment of the Rambam, he looked it up, and he said, oh, what I'm saying can't be, because I see based on this comment over here, it doesn't make sense. And he closed all of his books, and he said, I don't know, this is what I'm saying is wrong. On his probe to become the Rebbe. So the Rabbanim all got together, and they said, afterwards, they said, a Rebbe who's ready to do that, the embarrassment for the pursuit of truth, on a comment that none of us knew, he could have just ignored the whole thing, and nobody would have said anything, that's the Rebbe that we want to have. And the Rav used to quote that story all the time, because he would often come into shir, and the following week after he would come in, he'd say, what I said was wrong. And then Rav Shach was like, then he would yell at us, and he would say, how'd you let me get away with that? Clearly what I was saying didn't make any sense. But that was always... I've heard the Rav Shachter would say that sometimes, you know, in a yeshiva there's a cycle of mesachtas. They learn with 5, 6, 7 mesachtas, and every 5, 6, 7 years they go through the whole thing again. So the Rav gave shir for 45 years. So Rav Shachter was in a shir, I don't know how many years, many, many years. So on the third go-around, so the Rav would say over, he was working through a piece of the Gemara, and he would come to a certain conclusion. Rav Shachter would say, Rebbe, that's not the conclusion you drew last time. I know the Rosh Hashanah has a memory. We learned the sugya differently last time. And I was like, okay, this is how I see it now. That's how it is. Like, I'm not here to give shir just to be a recorder and to repeat what I did 7 years ago. I'm learning now. And now, after 7 years of additional learning, I see it this way. So this is how I learn it now. And who cares what I said 7 years ago? This is what I see now. 70 faces to Torah, and this is the way, there's no other way to say it. This is how I see it. That strength, the forcefulness in getting a truth in Torah as a person outside of the shir room, he was the sweetest of the sweet. And he was a rabbi's rabbi. Rivero Wein tells, again, he had many interactions with him, that he was a rav in Miami Beach, Rabbi Wein. So he would see a lot of rabbanim would come through. So one of the rabbanim who came through was Rav Soloveitchik would come through. And so he would give shiur when he was there, and the Rabbi Wein said he always would try to attend when he could, and they would strike up a conversation, and he said he always would ask me, Rabbi Wein was a young rav at the time, he said, what are the issues that a young rav faces? Tell me what are the troubles, what are the problems, what's it like having a community as a young American rabbi? He always wanted to be involved, and the Rabbi Wein would say, I'm dealing with this, and dealing with that, and the rav would say, ah, I'm dealing with that in Boston, ah, my grandfather, he dealt with that in Brisk. It's all the same. And he would say, Rabbi Wein says, and he would say to me, guess what? No one's ever going to solve it. This is what it is. These are the issues of what it's like to have a Jewish community. So, you know, deal with it. And that relationship, Rabbi Wein says, he used the Rav as a sounding board for many, many years. He would visit him in YU, and he was a source of support. He tells one story, I just have to share, it's an amazing story. Rabbi Wein, after he left Miami Beach, he took a position as the executive director in the OU, and shortly after that, he was shifted to the head of the Kashrus division. So he was running Kashrus, which Rabbi Wein describes as a miserable position. Very, very difficult, and he says almost all the issues we had had nothing to do with Kashrus. Kashrus was easy. It was all of the pressures and the politics from all the different factions. Like, he says, unbelievable. So he said one issue that they had shortly after he started was with El Al. El Al at that time still was flying on Shabbos, and they had a food provider, I think it was called Bornstein's, which since doesn't exist anymore, and they, OU, gave the hashkacha to the food that provided the food for the airlines. And in the 3 months before Rabbi Wein took over, there was a vacancy in the position, and in that time, El Al switched their flight schedule, and they left 40 minutes after sunset on Saturday night. 40 minutes after sunset on Saturday night is, for most opinions, still Shabbos, or just at the very end of Shabbos. And so if you're taking off 40 minutes after sunset, so besides for the fact that the Orthodox community certainly couldn't take advantage of the flight, which is not such a big deal, whatever it was, but they had a problem getting the food. So they were getting the food on Shabbos from the warehouse, or wherever it was, and bringing it over. And eventually the OU found out about it. Now, there's probably a way around it, but it violated every policy that a kashrus organization has, that you come and you get the food on Shabbos. So the OU abandoned, and they said, we're not delivering the food until an hour after sunset, which means that they couldn't depart until about an hour after 2 hours, based on the schedule. And as Rabbi Wein tells the story, he says, you have no idea what this created. He got phone calls from every single person in Israel. They got from the consulate, from the embassy, everybody. That they switched the schedule on El Al, and they forced El Al to now fly an hour and a half after Shabbos. It got, and then he gets a call from the Rav. Rabbi Wein, as the head of the OU Kashrus, gets a call from the Rav, and the Rav says, I want to talk to you about El Al. He says, yes, Rabbi. So he said, I got a call from a member of Knesset, from the religious party, called me to address this issue that how can we, this is this a terrible thing that we threw off El Al's schedule, and you know, everyone's claiming anti-Semitic and anti-Zionist, all the, so the religious member of Knesset calls the Rav and says, I need you to work with Rabbi Wein at the OU, figure this out. So Rabbi Wein says, okay. So Rabbi Soloveitcher, the Rav says, do you want to know what I told him? So he says, yes, Rabbi, what did you tell him? He said, I told him if it would be Swiss Air, I would find a heter. But for El Al, what the OU says, no permissibility, we're not changing. They're not going to deliver the food till an hour after Shabbos, and that's the way it's going to be. And Wein said, that was the end of the discussion. He didn't get another phone call from anybody. And it wasn't a halachic issue. It was a policy issue. Halachically, we could have found this, that, and the other. The OU has a policy, the standards. And when the Rav says, that's the way it's going to be, that was simply the way it was going to be. And that's how it went. Interestingly, he said another story, Rabbi Wein, that the Rav gave a hechsher to a product in Boston, and the OU didn't accept it. The OU did not accept the product that the Rav gave a hechsher to and bought. They wouldn't use it under anything under the OU. If you wanted to use that product in the manufacturing and the production of the product, you couldn't use that product. And Rabbi Wein tells us, I always felt that it was just bizarre. I mean, this is my Rebbe. He wasn't his actual. This is Rav Soloveitchik. He gives the hechsher. But it was a prior policy before Rabbi Wein took over the OU kashrus. And he dreaded the day that it would come up. And eventually it came up. And the Rav mentioned once this policy, this product. And Rabbi Wein said, I know. And then the Rav said, but I wanted to tell you something. He said, I never want the OU to accept this product. He said, why not? So the Rav said to him, because this product is kosher. I give my own hashgacha to it. But it's not up to the standards of the OU. It's kosher, and kosher standards are 1,000 standards. So for my people in Boston, I said it's okay. But it's not up to your standards. And I don't want you to ever change your standards. I want the OU to represent what it needs to represent. It has to have a high certain standard. And I'm telling you, even though I'm giving my hechsher to it, it's good for the community that I need over there, for whatever reasons, as every Rav needs in his community, needs whatever he needs to do, but it's not up to the national standards of OU and what the OU needs to be. I don't want you to ever accept it. And Wein said, the brilliance, not only did he get it, but that he made me at ease over this situation, but can you imagine this? What a fascinating situation, which the Rav is giving a hechsher to a product, and he himself says, but it's not it's kosher. I wouldn't give my hechsher on it otherwise. But you know, there's kosher and then there's... And the OU has to have a certain standard, and I want that standard to be upheld, despite that. One last anecdote with Rabbi Wein. He tells a great series of anecdotes. I just have to tell us. So after the OU, Rabbi Wein became the Rav in Muncie. He was the Rosh Hashiva and the Rav of a shul in Muncie. See, he married off the president of his shul's son to the granddaughter of Rabbi Lamb. I forget exactly the details. It was his president to the president of Yeshiva University's granddaughter is a big to-do. And of course, the Rav was going to be the Masader Kiddushin. So the ksuva that they had produced was one of those fancies that's well over $1,000. He's never seen anything like it before. And so Rabbi Wein is sitting there at the head of the table with the dais as the Rav of the chaslan and the whatever side it was, doesn't matter. And the Rav is filling it out and he sees something about it he doesn't like. The way that it was done. He says, these fancy ksuvas. And in front, at the chaslan's tish, rips the whole thing in half, puts it aside, takes out a yellow piece of legal pad paper, and by heart starts writing out a new ksuva. He said, the chassan is white. Absolutely just speechless. Rabbi Wein says, he turns to me and he says, I'm like, can you believe these fancy ksuvas? They never get it right. And Rabbi Wein has nothing to say. Like, just You couldn't. So he writes the whole thing out, and he says to the Chassan, I'm going to give you something 10 times more valuable than any fancy schmancy ksuva you can ever have. And he has, and Rabbi Wein says, now, it's 20, 30 years later, can you imagine something any more valuable than a handwritten ksuva from the Rav? But it was a what needs to be a truth, and that's the way that it was going to be. His shiurim, let me give you a quote from one of his students. His shiurim were the most captivating shiurim I was privileged to hear in my life. The excitement, the heightened expectations that he engendered, together with his scintillating analysis, left one riveted and transfixed. In the course of his shiurim, we were catapulted to rhapsodic heights of kedusha. I felt as I were soaring on the wings of eagles, having been wafted on a magic carpet of sorts. He was a masterful, masterful darshan. His understanding of Torah, the way he put things together, and he was an orator with enthusiasm and charisma. You needed a dictionary to listen to him. Whether he was speaking in Yiddish or English, which was probably his third language, to read his works, you have to have a dictionary, no matter what language he was speaking in. And the excitement, the passion that he had when he taught, left his students literally in awe. He would give shiurim. He had weekly shiurim, both in Boston and in New York. And then he gave an annual yortzeit shiur, the yortzeit of his father, on the 3rd of Shvat. He would give a shiur. He would pack literally 1,500 people. I know, I was in high school in that building. He would pack the auditorium, 1,500 people, and he would darshan for 4 hours, 2 hours in halacha and 2 hours in agadata, and he would just go straight. He gave tshuva drushes, which were later published in a series of works as well. And they were just, people were, it was, you were enraptured by the way that he spoke and the level of learning that he was able to convey. I've heard it described as a mechanic that you would take a fancy car, break it down into its most basic pieces, show you how each piece worked, and then put the whole thing back together so you understood it. Like, oh, of course. So I didn't understand a thing before. I looked at this piece of Talmud, this passage, and I don't understand the start from the end. And then he would break it down, starting from the beginning, working its way up, and then put the whole thing back together in a way that was just this magnificent, magnificent piece. And it came because of his deep personal relationship with Torah. And I just need to share a few anecdotes to describe, because that's really where it came from. We described already how his mother gave him the life of mitzvos, how she gave him his soul of what it meant to keep Shabbos. But he had this intimate relationship with the Torah itself. And he used to often quote, Pshachter says, he used to quote a Gemara, which I'm sure many of you have heard, that the Gemara says that when an infant, an embryo, is in its mother's womb, there's an angel that comes and teaches it, Kol HaTorah Kula, teaches it all of Torah, and then when the child is born, it gets a little tap on its lip, and he forgets everything. So the Rav used to say, well, why is that necessary? If you forget everything anyway, what's the value of learning it all? And the Rav used to explain, because that would give it, it's a part of who you are. Every Jew is connected to Torah deep inside of his soul, even before he learns the Aleph Beis. But for his entire life, he takes with him a personal connection. It's mine. It's who I am. It's the air I breathe. And so that when you then engage in the study of Torah, you're just connecting to a piece of who you are. And he would quote the Gemara, Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe, Mo Rasha Ki Hilat Yaakov. Torah is our inheritance. It's a Mo Rasha. And the Gemara has a drasha in which it reads it as if it says Me'urasa. There's two stages of a wedding, Erusin and Kiddushin. Erusin is when the groom gives his bride the wedding ring, and then the final step is standing under the chuppah and the sheva brachos. But that first stage, everyone is considered engaged, has a relationship with Torah. Then you have to work to make it into the second stage of Nisuin, where it's yours, you have an intimate knowledge, but it's part of who you are. And that's literally how he lived. And I want to bring that out, but in order to bring that out, I need to just backtrack to a couple of other stories to really describe that. His wife passed away young in 1967, relatively young in 1967. And he went into a terrible mourning period. It was actually a terrible year for him. He lost not only his wife, but his mother and a brother in a 12-month period. And he was noticeably terribly depressed, particularly from the loss from the loss of his wife. I actually want to read to you something which he described in one of his tshuva drushas before Yom Kippur. It's, I think, your final source on page 6. No, the top of page 6. Very, very poignant piece. He writes, on the seventh day of Pesach in 1967, the Rav died in Chol HaMoed Pesach himself, 30 years later. I awoke from a fitful sleep, he describes. A thunderstorm was raging outside and the wind and rain blew angrily through the window of my room. Half awake, I quickly jumped to my feet and closed the window. I then thought to myself that my wife was sleeping downstairs in the sunroom next to the parlor. She'd been in a hospital bed at the end of her life. And I remembered that the window was left open there as well. She could catch pneumonia, which in her weakened state would be devastating. I ran downstairs, rushed into her room, and slammed the window shut. I then turned around to see whether she had awoken from the storm or were still sleeping. I found the room empty, the couch where she slept neatly covered. In reality, she had passed away the previous month. The most tragic and frightening experience was the shock that I encountered in that half second when I turned from the window to find the room empty. I was certain that a few hours earlier I had been speaking with her. And then at about 10 o'clock she had said goodnight and retired to her room. I could not understand why the room was empty. I thought to myself, I just spoke with her. I just said goodnight to her. Where is she? A very poignant human piece that is very powerful for, unfortunately, loss is a reality that we all experience. That shock. A month, 2 months, 3 months later of, what? I ran downstairs to take care. I turn around and she's not there. And he gave this as part of his tshuva drasha of the shock of Rosh Hashanah, of Yom Kippur, of living a life in which you think a certain reality and then all of a sudden awaking to the new reality and that perpetual shock that I'm familiar with this piece, I've spoken about so many times at a shiva house with those suffering a loss of the reiteration, the reliving, the pain, and he expresses it in such a human, such a personal, such a raw experience, and that entire, he mourned for years the loss of his wife. Rabbi J.J. Schachter, I quoted earlier, I mentioned the Rav never went to Eretz Yisrael. He went in 1935, and he never went back. And we're going to see what a religious Zionist he was. And it was odd that he never went, his whole life, he never went back. He died in 1993. Never. Rabbi J.J. Schachter said, he said he didn't hear this from him, but he understood from him that when he was in Boston, when he started in New York in 1940, for years his wife said to him, "We need to go, let's go visit Israel." And he always was too busy. He never stopped teaching. Summers always between the shul and school in Boston and Yeshiva University, it was always another season. Always pushed it off. And finally, after years. In 1966, he said, "Finally, we'll go this summer." And that summer, she took ill, and she died. They never weren't able to go, and she died the following season, the following spring of 1967. And then the war broke out in June of 67, and Rabbi J.J. Schachter said that he couldn't go. He couldn't go without her. His whole life, she wanted to go, and he kept saying, "We'll go, we'll go, we'll go, we'll go." And then she died. And for the rest of his life, he couldn't go. And for all that he stood, and we'll see by the end what the value that he placed and the representation that he was for the entire Zionist, modern Orthodox world, he couldn't go. And just, it wasn't a philosophical thing, it wasn't a theological thing, it was a human thing. Just couldn't get himself to go. Rabbi Wein, and this is all leading up to what I want to get to in a moment, Rabbi Wein says that he used to call him always before Yontif. And after his wife died, when he would call, the Rav would say to Rabbi Wein that he's terribly lonely. Terribly lonely. And he said to Rabbi Wein, he said, "Loneliness is the greatest, worst punishment that a human being can experience in life. it's the worst. And he would say, as a human, he was just terribly lonely after the death of his wife. And he told Rabbi Wein, and this circles back to the point that I wanted to make, is there's only one solace that I have in life from the loneliness that I experience. When I walk into my shiur room, and I open up my Gemara, and I'm sitting with Rav and Abaye, and Rashi's by my side, and together we're fighting with Tosfos. And then the Rambam comes into the room, and the Rambam says, "You're learning it all wrong. It's not like what Rashi says, it's like this." And then I would pick up the Rambam and I would understand where he's coming from. And then I would feel my grandfather, Reb Chaim, on my shoulder. And Reb Chaim would say to me, "You see how the Rambam's learning?" And then I would say to him, "Yeah, but what about what Tosfos said?" And when I'm together with Rashi and with Tosfos and Ravina and Rav and Abaye, that's my only solace from the loneliness. And then when I close my Gemara and I walk out of my room, I'm overcome. I'm overcome with my grief and my loneliness. But that was such a human experience that he would describe of both his relationship, his deep, passionate, intimate relationship with learning, with his Gemara, and the human personality, the side that he had from his life experiences. He was an amazing combination of a Mesorah. He was a person who had a tradition. He learned with his father, I mentioned, until his early 20s. And everything he said in learning, he would quote his father, quote his grandfather. It was not making the, this is the tradition that I have. He had a tradition, the Rav Shachter would say, he had three Mesorahs that he would quote. I have a Mesorah in learning. I have a Mesorah in how to paskin, how to answer a shayla. And he had a Mesorah in hashkafa, and how a Jew is supposed to think. How a Jew believes. What a Jew is allowed to believe. What a Jew is not to believe. All of that requires a Mesorah. You have to have a tradition. What we do, what we don't do. How we think and how we don't think. How do you paskin a shayla? Shechter said he once complained in a published essay that he feels he succeeded in teaching his students Torah, but he did not succeed in teaching his students how to feel about the Torah. He complained, he rued that he felt he was unsuccessful in giving over the passion, giving over the sentiments, giving over the attitude that he got from his father and grandfather and from his mother, that he wasn't able to convey. He conveyed the learning, but he wasn't able to convey the attitude. He once complained about that. So I think it's interesting. I saw in all the eulogies and all that I was looking around, one of his students wrote the following about him. I put it in here. I think the Rav would have been very proud to have seen this. The student said, "I forgot almost all of the classes that I took with my Rebbe, but I once had the privilege to sit at his Seder table. And I'll never forget the way he said Hallel at the Seder table." I think that would be a great solace to the Rav, that indeed, while he himself might have felt that he failed in conveying some of the feeling and the emotion and the passion and the attitude, it's not quite as dire as he might have thought, that his students' experience of his passion of learning, of what it meant to say Hallel at the Seder table with the Rav, did in fact, was transmitted from one generation to the next. That was a little bit about his place just in learning. We need to discuss this on page 3. He was also he was a philosopher, and he was the father of what we would define today of modern orthodoxy. The current tagline of Yeshiva University, Torah Umada, Torah and secular wisdom, and he stood for and deepened the idea of the synthesis of these two ideas of the best of religious Torah scholarship combined with the best of secular scholarship in Western civilization. And I'd like to share a little bit with you one of his seminal works, The Lonely Man of Faith, which he published in 1965. I gave you a long quote on the first quote in your addendum. We don't have time to go through the whole thing. But I want to share a little bit because it's such a classic work and so oft quoted. He's discussing in this, it's on the top of page 4, there are two accounts in the beginning of Bereshis of the creation of man, of Adam. Adam 1, he calls him, and Adam 2, Adam 1 and Adam 2, in two consecutive chapters. And the descriptions the Torah gives are a little bit different, and he goes through an entire analysis, which we're not going to go through. But he begins that the nature of the dilemma can be started in a three-word sentence. I am lonely. Now, this loneliness is a different type of loneliness than he's one experienced 2 years later, which is the human loneliness of the death of his wife. This loneliness, he says, is not that I'm alone, but he's lonely as an observant Torah Jew in the modern world. And what he means and what he expresses in the second paragraph is, he says, what does a man of faith do? He's a stranger in modern society. Because on the one hand, the modern society is technically minded, self-centered, and self-loving. This is still in the 60s. Forget about what he would say now. Almost in a sickly, narcissistic fashion, honor upon honor, piling up victory upon victory, reaching for the distant galaxies, placing a man on the moon. What can a man of faith, who lives by a doctrine which has no technical potential, by a law which cannot be tested in a laboratory, a halachic man who's steadfast in his loyalty to this vision of fulfillment that doesn't work, where does he belong in such a world? A utilitarian society whose practical reason, what do I do? Where am I? See, he says that this incongruity, which is getting back to the two accounts of creation, is not in an alleged dual tradition like the Bible critics would contend, but in a dual man. That mankind in the Rav was famous for always finding it throughout, as he did in learning, being able to find the chakira, two different sides of looking things, two different aspects, two different traits. And so there are two versions of man. One, they're not an imaginary contradiction, but two versions, in a real contradiction in the nature of man. The two accounts deal with the two Adams, which are two men, two fathers of mankind, two types, two representatives of humanity. And it's no wonder that they're not identical. When he describes them, it's pages upon pages. So I brought a brief synopsis written by Dr. David Schatz, as I mentioned earlier. The first Adam, these are not the words of the Rav, this is the words of David Schatz summarizing it, seeks to fill the earth and subdue it, meaning to conquer, to create, to dominate, to control. This was later made famous by David Brooks, what he calls resume virtues and eulogy virtues. David Brooks made this famous. It's so fascinating that he always quotes the Rav. He quotes from Joseph Soloveitchik for giving him this idea that there's one type of us which is a resume virtue. We want to accomplish. We want to fill the world with things and dominate. And that's Adam 1, to harness and to dominate the elemental natural of forces and use them to their disposal. But Adam the second, which David Brooks refers to as eulogy virtues, has different goals. He's not interested in how things work and controlling them. He wants to know, why do the cosmos exist at all? What's the message? What's the inner experience, this life, this loneliness, this awareness of his uniqueness? What's the goal? He thirsts for redemption. Those are the two functions of man, and they're contradictory, and they both exist within us at all times. The part of us that wants to control, to dominate, and the part of us that just wants to feel like, why are we here? What's the meaning of all of this? And they're both there, and as the Rav expresses at great length, the lonely man of faith trying to find his way in a world in which the world only exists in the secular world, in Adam 1, but a religious man, a man of faith, says it's more than just conquering the world. What's the point of all of this? And trying to find his way to synthesize his existence in a secular world with and infuse it with religious meaning. Halachic Man, which I gave you, it's on page 6, the summary as well, in which he describes again, as he does, cognitive man, religious man, and halachic man. See, he describes that the goal is halachic man, which means that he sees the world through the realm of halacha. What does Jewish law tell me that I need to do in this circumstance? That's the glasses that I wear that allow me to interpret the things around me. Just the second to last paragraph, just as an example, he describes. For halachic man, seeing the first light of dawn is not just an aesthetic experience. Oh, how beautiful. Rather, his first thought is, oh, time to say Shema. I see the world and the beauty of it and how it relates to my life as a Jew. That's an amazing experience. Is there a bracha I'm supposed to make on this experience? Am I supposed to say Shema right now? I encounter a natural spring of water. Could that be used as a mikvah? Could it not? I see the world through those halachic glasses. If you want to read more, you can see there. And you can certainly look up online more. But we have more to cover, so I want to keep moving so we can finish this up. This tension between modernity and orthodoxy really manifests itself in almost all areas of his public life. For example, he defended the authority of the rabbinate, which was a big issue in the 60s and the 70s. He fought against halachic change, meaning he was against the campaign of mixed seating in shul. He opposed theological dialogue with reform and conserve on a theological level, but he pioneered Talmudic education for girls. He abandoned the Brisker family tradition by supporting Zionism, which we'll get to in a moment. He advocated cooperation with the non-Orthodox, even with the Christians, in pursuit of social justice. So when it came to theology, he didn't want to talk with the Christians or reform or conservative. When it came to social, of course we have to join together with them to be the best that we can and to aid. And it was always a balance of a halachic man living in a modern secular world, and how do we bridge this gap, this new world that we are in. Last major piece that I want to cover with you is his position on Zionism, a major, major piece as part of his life. He came from this Brisker dynasty, the Soloveitchik family, which were anti-Zionist, and he was originally a member of the Aguda. And that changed with the Holocaust and the years following the Holocaust. And he put that in a lecture, which became a book called Kol Dodi Dofek, which is a phrase from Shir HaShirim, the knock of my beloved, or my beloved is knocking, depending on how we'll translate that, which was translated into English with the title Fate and Destiny in 1956. He delivered this lecture on Yom HaAtzmaut in Yeshiva University in 1956 to set the context of this discussion, this book, this lecture that he originally gave. 1956 was on the cusp of another war. The winds of war already began in 1955. The Israeli government had already asked the U.S. for military aid and were denied because the U.S. was still trying to deal with Russia and with Nasser and Egypt, and they didn't want to get involved. And it was a frightening time for the fledging Jewish state. And in the back of everyone's mind is the Holocaust. We're 8 years removed. 9 years, 8 years removed from the state, 10 years removed, 11 years removed from the end of the Holocaust, no one has forgotten. And the fear of another Holocaust to all the Jews who had now made it and were in this fledging state, 8-year-old state in Israel, was the cloud that loomed over this time period. And on Yom HaAtzmaut in 1956, with the American apathy that was still a sour taste in everyone's mind from World War II, what's going to be now with 1956. And the Rav delivers this lecture, Kol Dodi Dofek, in a couple of sections. The opening section, he gives a thesis on the idea of suffering. He opens the discussion with personal suffering. So even though he's going to lead into the Holocaust and Zionism, he has a major approach on suffering, which we'll present as a parenthetical thing. I gave it to you on, I think it's this page 4. We'll mention just briefly, in which he discusses the idea of suffering. He has one basic comment, which I'll mention. You could read the whole thing there. That is, a Jew does not ask the question of why. That question, why did this happen, is not a theological question that a Jew can ask, because we don't have an answer to that question. And it's of no value to ask theological questions that have no answer. All that that does is it paralyzes us. But what a Jew needs to ask is, what am I to do in this situation? What is it that I'm required to act? How is it that I'm required to respond to this personal tragedy, to the national tragedy? What does God want from me in this? Why did He put me in this situation? Good luck. We don't know. Moshe Rabbeinu can't answer that question. Shlomo Melech can't answer that question. And certainly anybody living through the whatever tragedy we're living through doesn't have an answer to the why did this happen. What is my job in this situation? What is my task? What is my response? That is an empowering, healthy question. And he uses that to describe the difference between what he calls fate and destiny. Fate is just being thrown along history. Things happen to you. Destiny is taking, so to speak, the bull by the horns and saying, what do I make of the situation that I have been placed in? What am I to do with these circumstances that I've been given? I don't want this situation. I don't like these circumstances. I don't know why I'm in this. It doesn't matter. What am I to do with this? So you could read that inside. He uses that to then springboard into his position on Zionism. This is 1956. The more religious, what we would call Haredi yeshivish approach, was very anti-Zionistic at this time. And if you remember from all the previous classes we discussed, because the Zionist movement was passionately anti-religious. And the Rav, breaking from that, which took a tremendous amount of courage, in today's day and age it's a little bit different, tremendous amount of courage, described the six knocks. Six knocks on the door. And what he did is he developed a thesis, a beautiful, beautiful approach, based on the Pasuk in Shir HaShirim, that my beloved knocks. And Shir HaShirim describes the reunion between two lovers who had been separated for an amount of time. And the male, the husband, we don't know exactly, whatever, comes home and he knocks on the door. And his beloved is already in bed. And she's already changed into her pajamas. And she says, "I can't get out of bed." And he's knocking. And she says, "It's too late." And he's knocking. And she says, "I already changed. I'm going to have to put on my clothing again." And he's knocking. And she says, "I'm going to have to put on my slippers. I don't have the kayach." And then finally she drags herself out of bed and opens up the door. And her beloved is gone. And the Rav said, trying to empower and galvanize the American Jewish community, he said, "It's time. And our beloved is knocking. And the only question is, are we going to open up the door?" And he quantified six knocks, which I have in very brief, on the top middle page 5, the end of the first paragraph, first box. He said, "Here are the six knocks that are taking place." And what he did is he put into words things which everybody was sort of aware of, but weren't able to put into the historical context the way that he did in his beautiful, eloquent language. He said, number one, in the political arena, the fact that we were given the state and that world powers have come together and acknowledged the Jewish state in a way that had not happened in 2,000 years. We have, in the political arena, in alliances between Russia and the U.S. in regards to Israel, which were unheard of in the times of the Cold War. There's something happening that's shifting the sands of time. It's happening in front of us. In the battlefield, the Jews won in 1948. This is still even before 67. But if we won. The last Jewish a victory in a battlefield was 2,000 years prior. We won a war. The theological disproof to 1,000 years of Christianity. For 1,000 years, since the Middle Ages, the Jew had been badgered by the Christians that you've been abandoned. We are now the chosen people, and look, we measure in the billions, and you, or maybe a billion, or certainly hundreds of millions, and you, nothing. Downtrodden, inquisitioned, pogromed, Holocaust, we're it. And we didn't really have a response. We could say we believe. And then all of a sudden, in 1948, there's a state of Israel is reborn. Unheard of in the history of mankind that a people exiled for 2,000 years comes home. And as much as people, says the Rav, there was a knock that said 1,000 years of our history was just flipped on its head. 1,000 years of theological arguments with a single vote, all of a sudden it became, oh really? Where's the church now and where are we? That was knock number 3. In the hearts of perplexed and assimilated youths, describing the invigorated feeling of Zionism, of a return to Judaism, that Jewish blood is not free. Jewish blood had been free for 1,000 years. Killed in the streets throughout Europe, and there was no one to turn to, no one who cared. And now there was. Now there was a country that went after, wherever in the world, when they pulled Eichmann out of Argentina. This is, now he wasn't writing specifically about that, that idea that there is a country and that Jewish blood is not free. And lastly, the fact that the gates of our homeland are opened. He said, Hashem is knocking. The beloved is knocking. And the response of the Jew is, open the door. And he, in a bold and daring break from his family and from the world that he came from, left the Aguda and joined Mizrahi and said, we must support Zionism and the state of Israel. And that has become the position. Now it's ready again. It's easy. It's easy today. Even the camps that were anti-Zionist, it's a different world 50 years later. But then was a very, very bold, and he spent the rest of his life as the outcast in a certain way with his family. In learning, nobody could touch him. Nobody could touch him. Not in Brisk, not in Lakewood, not in Chaim Berlin. Everybody knew that he was the gadol that he was in learning. But in his approach to Zionism and some other, not learning boys and girls, learning, he did a number of things which did not fly in that world, and he was always, therefore, on the outside, despite being the scion of the dynasty that he was, and his brilliance in learning. But they don't call him the father of modern Orthodoxy for nothing, because he did and created a world that was significantly different than the world that he came. But over his 45 years of giving shir, as I mentioned, ordaining over 2,000 rabbis, he has put his stamp in a way that cannot be, will never be fully even grasped and cannot be denied. I'll leave with two last quotes. Back in 1935 already, he wrote after his trip to what was then called Palestine, he said, "The future of Palestine is with Orthodoxy, just as the future of Orthodoxy lies in Palestine." I make the statement not as a rabbi, but as an objective observer. 1935, this is still 13 years before the state and way before he writes his 1956 article. That's where he saw the future of Palestine is with Orthodoxy and the future of Orthodoxy is with Palestine. Prophetic words which have indeed come true. Well, let me conclude with a quote from Rabbi Norman Lamb in a 1993 eulogy that he delivered. Discussing this... the legacy of the Rav, to be remembered as a philosopher, to be as a traditional rabbi. He said the Rav was not a Lamdin who happened to have and use a smattering of general culture. He wasn't just a learned Jew who happened to know how to use general culture to his advantage. And he was certainly not a philosopher who happened to be a Talmud Chacham. Which one was he? Was he a Talmud Chacham who happened to know a lot of secular studies? Was he a philosopher who happened to be a Talmud Chacham? He says he was neither. We must accept him on his terms as a highly complicated, profound, and broad-minded personality who encompassed really all of that. And the legacy that he left, the stamp that he gave to the American Jewish scene through his learning, we didn't even really get to, because I'm already a little bit over time. There's the numbers of books that continue to be published, the number of commentaries of his. There wasn't an aspect of Torah that he didn't comment on that a student has notes on that is not now publishing. 25 years later, they just now came out with a commentary of Chumash in the last couple of years. His commentary on Chumash, dozens and dozens, probably hundreds of books on him from students, on their recollections, his commentary, his sermons. It's unending, because he commented on everything. He had an insight on everything, a philosophical approach to everything. And he was the Rebbe of Yeshiva University, the Rebbe of modern Orthodoxy in America. And I know that I did not do it justice, because there were so many other aspects which I didn't cover. But I hope, as a final installment of our 20 weeks together, that I gave a flavor, a taste of the Rav, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, Rav Yoshe Ber, as he was referred to. And we conclude with a wonderful, really, series of 20 weeks, a tremendous amount of learning that we've done together. And kol hakavod again to you for coming week in and week out. We'll have some other sessions, I guess, throughout the summer. And then next year, after Sukkot, we'll start series number two, which will roll out shortly. So that... that brings our lecture series to a close for now. Series number one. I'll dive in Marv in shul, and I wish you all a wonderful evening.